Okay, so we got an invitation from the SOC to try a bit of an experiment at this meeting to have different views on the same topic and try to get an interactive or a mixed talk about this. So in the end, it was decided that myself and Alat Jan could talk about both shocks. So we agreed to do this, and but still, it's the first time we actually do this, so I hope it goes well. So today, Alat Jan and I will talk about both shocks in the concept of stellar wind ISM interactions. So this is a bit more confined than general both shocks in all kinds of different environments and concerning jets and all these things. So we focus on hot stars, which have these both shock regions, and we focus on old cool stars, which also have these both shock regions. So why would we care so much about both shocks or the astrospheres around stars? Well, actually, we can use them to learn quite a lot about the stars and also the medium in which they reside. So first, we can use them as an independent proxy of the recent history of the stellar winds of these objects. We can also use them to probe the local interstellar medium in which they are moving. They can be used to, in other studies, we can use them to identify runaway stars, which are important to stellar evolution and dynamics and stellar systems. We can also do more microphysics, or studying really the physics of the dust and dust grain and gas coupling in this region. So how do dust and gas interact? And even go try to see if there's any processing of dust, any chemistry, so to say, or physics in these regions, which might affect how stars and their mass loss is, in the end, affecting the evolution of the interstellar medium. So there might be some region where there is some where changes can occur, which you would naively maybe not consider. And then in the end, they can also affect the evolution of stellar and even planetary systems. Like for our own sun, the heliosphere is protecting the Earth and these other planets from harmful radiation, for example. So these different reasons sort of give us a motivation to study both shocks, wind ISM interaction in both shocks. So I give you a quick outline. First, Alat Jan will discuss the concept of both shocks, and then we will go through the some examples of cool old stars, and then the next hot young stars. And we see some differences and similarities between the two cases, and we try to end in time with some conclusions and some open questions.
Thank you. So for the continuation of our double act, we'll now start talking about what the concept of both shocks in general. So, as has already been touched upon briefly this morning, when a stellar wind expands into the interstellar medium, it inevitably has the shock. And that means that you get a layered structure. Basically, you have a central star from which the wind expands in all directions. Eventually, it hits a point where it shocks, which we usually call the wind termination shock, and there most of its kinetic energy goes into thermal energy. So what you get is a layer of shocked wind material, which is very hot, because all the kinetic wind energy, which especially for hot stars with fast-moving winds is considerable, is transferred into thermal energy. And it means that this region has a very high thermal pressure. Because it has a high thermal pressure, it will try to expand outward into the interstellar medium, sweeping it up into a shell. So you get a system that has four layers. You have unshocked wind, shocked interstellar medium, and unshocked, undisturbed interstellar medium. And it's separated by the wind termination shock on the inside, the so-called forward shock on the outside, and what we call the contact discontinuity in between the two shocked gas layers. This is a very simple idea. It was proposed by Weaver et al. In the 1970s. And it rests on a number of assumptions, one of which is that the central star is standing still. If the central star starts moving, then this perfect sphere is disturbed. And if the star is moving supersonically with respect to the outside medium, we we get what we call a bow shock, which actually looks like this. In a bow shock, you still have a central star, which has a wind that expands in all directions. But you no longer have a sphere around it. Rather, you have a sort of parabola, which is, again, split up in layers. You have the unshocked wind, which, again, has to shock eventually in the wind termination shock. You get a layer of shocked wind, but it is severely disturbed because the forward motion of the star basically causes the shock material to be swept aside. Outside the shocked wind, you now have, again, a shocked interstellar medium, and outside that, you have the unshocked medium. And for historical reasons, the terminology changes a little bit. So the actual bow shock here is the forward shock. The wind termination shock still has the same name. And the area where the thermal pressure of the shocked interstellar medium balances against the thermal pressure of the shocked wind is usually called the astropause, or in the case of the solar system, we call it the heliopause. The area between the two shocks, again, we call it the astrosheaf if we talk about another star, we call it the heliosheaf if we talk about the sun. And these bow shocks are unique when it comes to stellar bubbles, because if you look at the stellar bubble, you're basically seeing an echo of the expanding wind of the past. All the wind that the star has emanated over its existence is locked up inside this bubble, which means that you really see a fossil of what has happened. A bow shock is different. The total time scale for the wind to leave the star, hit the shock, and ultimately be swept away is typically short. Well, short in the order of tens of thousands of years, which is short compared to the lifetime of the star. And it means that when you look at a bow shock, you see the effect of the wind and the ISM as they are today, rather than as they used to be over the past couple of million years that that star has existed. Now, we can do an analytical estimation of how big a bow shock is going to be. And this was done by Wilkin in 1996. And he said that what he called R0, the standoff distance, which is the distance between the star and the front of the astropause, depends on the mass loss rate and the wind velocity, as well as on the density, the velocity, and the sound speed in the interstellar medium. It's just a matter of balancing the ram pressure of the oncoming interstellar medium versus the ram pressure of the wind. And this equation is very useful for two reasons. For one thing, the dependence of R0 on the parameters of the wind and the interstellar medium is relatively strong. If you look at spherical bubbles like this, you will see that the dependence is weak. Typically, for example, the size of the bubble depends, just for example, on the interstellar medium density to the power minus 1/5, which means that you cannot use the size of the bubble to determine interstellar medium density. That dependence is just too weak. You'd have a huge margin of error. Here, it's much stronger. The second important point is that there is no explicit time dependence in here. As long as these variables themselves don't change, the shock is effectively static. And it's very useful because time is quite often very difficult to determine. If I look at a circumstellar bubble like this, and I want to say something about its development, well, then I have to know how old the central star is. And quite often, that is not so easy to determine. If you have a star that lives 100 million years, I honestly don't know at a given point whether it's 50 or 60 million years old. So bow shocks can be very useful if you want to determine wind and interstellar medium parameters. And just to give you an idea of the kind of numbers you get up with, we have three examples here. An old, cool star, like, for example, a red supergiant, a young hot star, a B or an O star, and yeah, just for completion, a G star like the sun. And we fill in typical wind parameters. So a cool star typically has a slow wind, decent mass loss rate. Hot stars have much faster winds, and actually mass loss rates, which are kind of similar, despite, of course, the fact that the density of the wind is going to be completely different. And yeah, then there is the sun with a reasonable wind velocity, but the mass loss rate is not exactly impressive. We send these stars moving at a reasonable speed through the interstellar medium. We give estimates for interstellar medium density, one particle per centimeter cubed, sort of average. For the Sun, we know that the local interstellar medium is actually very low density. And we work out what are the typical standoff distances. And as you can see, it varies quite a bit. For your old cool star, you expect the standoff distance for the Boshoks, so in the order of 1/10 to 1 parsec. For young hot stars, it can be quite a bit more, up to 10 parsec. And yeah, for the Sun, because the wind is so weak, the standoff distance is actually very short, typically in the order of a couple of hundred AU. Now, of course, this is an idealized representation. In practice, Boshoks are rarely that smooth. And in fact, Boshoks can be very unstable. And as Ghani et al. Worked out in 1996, for a Boshok with an infinite Mach number, so we're just pretending that the material is completely cold and assume that it's completely isothermal, then there are two regimes. If the wind velocity from the star is much larger than the actual speed of motion of the star through the ISM, then the Boshoks will by and large be stable. You can still have small instabilities along the interaction fronts, but the shape of the Boshok itself will follow that idealized parabola. On the other hand, if the wind is actually slower than the speed at which the star moves, the Boshoks are going to be highly unstable with instabilities on the same scale as the actual Boshoks. Here, shown just in a drawing, so here we have the case where the wind is much faster than the stellar motion. Here we have the opposite. A very simple simulation already shows it. This was a case where I said, okay, I take a star, I move it faster than its wind speed, and as you can see here in the gas density distribution, here in the dust density distribution, the instabilities are huge. And in fact, an observation of R. Leo done with Herschel does show that kind of distortions of the Boshok shape. Another issue to be considered when we're talking about these kinds of circumstellar effects is the nature of the shocks. Are they radiative or adiabatic? In the case of an adiabatic shock, all the kinetic energy from both the relative motion of the ISM and the wind velocity is transferred to thermal energy, which is just contained in the shock. And it means you get high thermal pressures everywhere, which means that the shocked gas layers tend to be thick because they have that thermal pressure which pushes back against the ram pressure. Here, this is the case where all the shocks are completely non-radiative. We actually see a thick shocked wind and a thick shocked ISM. In the opposite case, if the shocks are completely radiative, you start losing your thermal energy almost immediately. The moment the kinetic energy is transferred to thermal, that hot gas cools down again. And that means that you lose your thermal pressure and your shocked gas layers are going to be very thin. And of course, there are possibilities for combinations. You can have a situation where your shocked wind is in fact radiative and your shocked ISM is adiabatic. And you get this situation, a very thin shell on the inside and a very thick shell on the outside. Or the opposite can happen, situation where you have an adiabatic wind shock but a radiative ISM shock, and you have an outer shell that is thin and an inner shell that is relatively thick. And which way this is going to go depends on the parameters. It depends on the density of the ISM and it depends on the velocity, because radiative cooling is highly dependent on the density of the gas. Typically it scales with density squared. So if you have a relatively dense material that shocks, it will be even denser because it gets compressed and it starts cooling immediately. If your material is relatively low density to begin with, well then even shocked, the density is not going to be high enough to give you significant radiation and will stay adiabatic. But we should consider that this is always a runaway effect, because the moment gas starts cooling, it loses thermal pressure, which means it's going to be compressed by its surroundings, which means that its density is going to increase, which means that it's going to cool even more, because like I said, radiative energy loss scales with density squared. It cools more, which means it loses more pressure, which means it gets compressed even more, which means that it has an even higher density, which means that it cools even more. And this, actually, if you do it numerically, has no end. It ends when you reach the resolution of your simulation. In practice, you typically reach a point where some heating source, like outside radiation, says, ho ho, wait a second, I'm keeping the gas at a certain temperature, and there it stops. I'm not going to let you cool even further. So this, in general, is the theory behind Bose-Shocks. And with that, I give the words to my colleague.
Almost stealing my slide there, but okay. So I briefly, I'm the observer, as clear, Jan is the theoretician, modeler, whatever. So I like to present pictures of observations, nice pictures. So I just, a very quick run through the history of detecting Bose-Shocks and astrospheres around cool stars. So it started the first one that was really detected in the infrared was the Betelgeuse Alpha Ori with IRAS. So it's a very large Bose-Shock because it's a nearby star and has a very large extended Bose-Shock region, which you can see here. And there's also some linear structure here, which is also fascinating. So this is basically the only one we could see around an evolved star with IRAS because of the spatial resolution was quite poor. But then a few years later, there was Spitzer and Toshiya Ueta made some nice surveys of a few stars like Hyadris and Arques, studying these Bose-Shock regions here. But then with Spitzer, the problem was that there was a very bright source, these HEB stars, red superdesigns, are very bright in the infrared, and they so it's difficult to get these faint extended structures resolved and from these central stars. The other option is this is Betelgeuse again by Toshiya, which he confirmed basically this arc structure and the linear bar with Akari. Again, Akari has a slightly better resolution than IRAS, but still not good enough to detect these kind of Bose-Shocks around many targets. So we had a few examples, and things seemed to be quite consistent with the theoretical, the analytical shapes predicted by Wilkin and so on, and the simulations. But then with Herschel, there was quite a nice program by Martin Groenewegen, and this was sort of a serendipitous discovery. For many of these objects, we discovered a lot of extended structures. So some of them show these nice Bose-Shock regions. Here you see the Arleo, which Alexian showed before, and many other detached shells, and they were irregular structures, and all these faint emission structures around these bright targets. So this could really be only detected because of the spatial resolution that became available with the Herschel space mission. And so we had quite a large sample of these Bose-Shock regions. So from a sample of like 80 HEB stars, red supergiants, there were at least 20 which has a nicely defined Bose-Shock structures, and some of them were quite smooth, while others were more irregular, so suggesting that there were some differences in the development of instabilities and so on. So from measuring the extended emission, which is only a very small fraction of the total infrared flux, so with IRAS or with other integrated flux measurements, you would never see any excess. It's too small. It's millipercentages of the total flux with respect to the central point. But what you can get from these infrared images is that about 1 to 20% only 1 to 20% is coming from the ISM dust, while all the other dust is coming from the evolved stars. So then we have, on the other end, there was also some nice results with GALAX, shown already before, where we have these Bose-Shocks in the gas emission. So we have supposedly H2 emission showing the Bose-Shocks. This was, there was another result by Ravendra Sahai, where he looked at GALAX at CW LEO, or ISC plus 10216, for those who like numbers better than names. So you see this very large, very nicely shaped Bose-Shock again, and here you see the radio profile in the two filters, in the far UV and the near UV. And again, here the theory was that this is excited H2 lines. In fact, with Herschel, one of the early results of the MESS program was that they also detected this gas Bose-Shock in dust emission. So there was a nice match between the dust and the gas in this object. Yes, and even further with neutral hydrogen, which Thibaut was mentioning before, they already inferred that there should be some interaction with the ISM just from looking at the line profiles. So this was nicely confirmed both in the gas and the dust, which allows for a nice analysis how these things interact between them. And now it's back to Alatjan.
Okay, so to continue on this type of star, Betelgeuse, of course, in many ways was the poster child for it. It's relatively nearby, and we had very detailed observations of it. And, well, then you hope that you get answers. Instead, what we got was questions, which in many ways was good for me, because I got paid trying to make simulations to solve the questions, and, well, I made a living out of it. So, Betelgeuse's Baumschok had several strange features. For one thing, there is this almost straight bar ahead of the Baumschok. And we spent a lot of time arguing whether or not it was part of the Baumschok structure or whether it was an interstellar medium feature which just happened to be there. Frankly, I think the discussion is still going on, which is good because it means people keep getting paid to run the simulations. The second interesting feature is that you have these multiple arcs in the Baumschok. And again, people spent a lot of time trying to figure out what these arcs could be. And one of the explanations that people came up with was that these are in fact evidence of an outside magnetic field. Tegani and Soker had actually predicted that this could happen if you had a Baumschok plowing into an interstellar medium that contained a weak magnetic field. And they figured out a calculation that would give you the strength of that interstellar magnetic field based on the separation of these arcs. And the funny thing is, when you figure that out, you say that according to the Herschel observations, the Alfvén speed in the interstellar medium would have been approximately 4 kilometers per second. And if you fill in a typical interstellar medium density of a couple of particles per centimeter cubed, that gives you a magnetic field of approximately 3 microgauss, and that is very good news, because that is actually a realistic magnetic field for the interstellar medium. And just to give people an idea, because the number, well, doesn't often make much sense, 3 microgauss is incredibly weak. If we take all the people in this room together, their combined brain activity comes close to producing 3 microgauss. It is that weak. The magnets you use to stick a grocery list...
What are you implying about our brains, Alatjan?
That our brains are almost as powerful as the interstellar medium okay. when it comes to generating magnetic fields. In fact, 3 microgauss, just for comparison, the magnets you use to stick a grocery list to your fridge are at least 6 orders of magnitude more powerful than this. An MRI, which you use to map somebody's nerve system, is in the order of 12 orders of magnitude more powerful than this. It is that pathetically weak. Which, of course, is also a problem because it makes detecting it rather difficult. But there was another question mark with Betelgeuse. Betelgeuse is a red supergiant, which means it has a very slow wind. And we have a pretty good idea of the forward motion of Betelgeuse, because at least as far as the transverse component, you can actually measure it on the sky by taking pictures of Betelgeuse over time. Betelgeuse is close enough to do that. And one of the things that comes out is that for Betelgeuse, the wind velocity is significantly less than the speed of motion of the star. And that's a problem, because as Tegani et al. Figured out in 96, that means that this Baumschok should be very, very unstable. And in fact, Briganti and Dercol, in the simulations 1 year earlier, had already shown that indeed that would happen. And everybody else, including myself, who ran simulations for that kind of setup, said, yep, you have gigantic instabilities, but I don't see them. And Herschel definitely had the resolution to resolve that kind of instability if they'd been there. In fact, this was the result I obtained when I ran the simulation. Here we see the gas density. Here we see the dust density. So we can't even use the excuse, well, we're looking in the infrared, we're looking at the dust, not at the gas, and maybe the dust doesn't follow these instabilities. I'm sorry, it does. And these kind of instabilities in the dust distribution would have been visible. And so we spent, again, lots of time discussing what could be happening here that Betelgeuse, which should have an unstable Baumschok, in fact, seems to have about the most stable Baumschok ever observed. And Well, a number of things came up. Jasreen, for example, and John Mackey posed the idea that it's a matter of time. Instabilities take time to form. Maybe Betelgeuse has not been a red supergiant long enough for these instabilities to show up. And that's a possibility. Another issue was that maybe the interstellar medium into which Betelgeuse is blowing is warm. If the interstellar medium is warm, that means that you have more thermal pressure, which means that these kind of instabilities have trouble forming. Again, it is a possibility, although then you'd have to come up with an argument, why is that interstellar medium warm? But, I mean, it is definitely possible. And there was one more option, and that is that once again, we're looking at a magnetic field. And, well, because of the stripes we saw, a magnetic field is definitely a possibility. It seems there is already evidence that a magnetic field is playing a role here. And so we tried to run a numerical model to show this. So I just slapped some numbers together. A mass loss rate, which is more or less correct for Betelgeuse. Typical wind velocity for a red supergiant. Stellar motion, this is the transverse stellar motion. Of course, there is a possibility that Betelgeuse is actually moving at an angle to our line of sight, but we can't know at all. An interstellar medium density of a few particles per centimeter cubed. Again, you can argue about the exact number, but this was not so much about exactly reproducing Betelgeuse as simply testing what will a magnetic field do. And so we added an interstellar magnetic field component. And yeah, for that, of course, I needed to know what kind of magnetic field do I put in. And what I came up with is that it can be anywhere between 1.4 and 5 microgauss. Note, that is for observations of, and I quote, the magnetic field in the Orionis arm of the galaxy, because there are no precise observations of the magnetic field near Betelgeuse. And with this kind of numbers, also keep in mind that typically the error bars around the magnetic field are larger than the total magnetic field strength that they observe. So there's a huge margin of error here. But still, something like 3 microgauss, which also followed out of the striping, seemed to be reasonable enough. And in order to make things easy for myself, I made that magnetic field parallel to the direction of motion, because that way I could preserve 2D symmetry, which in this case was very important because I needed a very high resolution to make this work. And so I ran a couple of simulations, of which I have two here. One, just the basic star in an interstellar medium that doesn't have any magnetic field. And a second one, where I said, okay, I put in that 3 microgauss magnetic field parallel to the direction of motion. Now, let's hope that this works. I think it does. So, there we have Betelgeuse moving. As you can see, the bow shock almost immediately breaks out into huge instabilities. Really instabilities big enough that they completely distort the shape of the shock. Okay, that was what we expected. I mean, we've been doing that for years. This was just a higher resolution copy of old work. But if we add the magnetic field, we get this. Yes, there are instabilities at the front, but they do not distort the shape of the shock. And they don't really grow much anymore. And in fact, what we see here is a combination of two effects. For one thing, just the presence of the magnetic field stops the instabilities from growing, because at this point, the instabilities have to try to push at a perpendicular angle to the magnetic field, and magnetic field lines don't like to be pushed away. Just the magnetic pressure will try to constrain it. The second thing is that the effect of the magnetic pressure will also limit the wavelengths of the instabilities that are allowed. It only allows long wavelengths, and that's why all the small-scale structure has completely disappeared. So I don't necessarily insist that this is the correct explanation, that it's the only explanation. Personally, I suspect there's a couple of things involved. Betelgeuse may very well be a relatively young red supergiant. There's a very good chance the interstellar medium is relatively warm, maybe in the order of 5,000 to 8,000 Kelvin. And the presence of a magnetic field in the interstellar medium is almost a given. Exactly how large it is depends on where you are. But, in fact, I ran tests also for 1.5 microgauss, and I went up to 5 microgauss, and the effect was always the same. It always reduced the instabilities. So I think that this definitely played a part in why we see Betelgeuse with its perfectly smooth bow shock rather than the huge instabilities that we were expecting. And I think with that...
Yeah, so it's nice to see that if you give a challenge to the simulation guy that, you know, if you give him time and money and computer power, he will find a solution to match your observations. And I think in the end, we have several of these people, and they always find nice different results. But okay, it's interesting to discuss further. And at least we see now that we can, you know, go from these early observations. We get a lot of theoretical predictions. We get the high resolution observations to confirm everything, and the models then confirm the confirmations. And we are back to the beginning, where we can make predictions again for the future observations. So now to these hot young stars, which were actually the stars for which the Bose shocks were detected ubiquitously, first with IRAS in the infrared, but also in the optical in the H-alpha already for sources like Alpha Cam and Zeta Off already. So Zeta Off is the one behind the screen. I've seen this. This is also a runaway star. So here you see. You see that these are very large structures, so that's why IRAS could resolve them. This is scale is 10 arc minutes. So this was basically the size of the Betelgeuse image before. You see here, these are gigantic structures in the sky. Most of these are also quite nearby. But you see infrared dust emission, you see near infrared from WISE, beautiful resolution, and H-alpha. And then from the H-alpha line profiles, you can study the radial distribution. To infer something about the shape, the conical shape, and it's a hollow shape or a filled shape, and so on. So this comes from H-alpha surveys, which you can use all sky surveys to detect these runaways. So, but what is required to detect these runaways is that the medium, that basically the star has to move supersonically through the medium. So it has to be a diffuse ISM, not too low density, not too high density. And the stellar wind has to be a proper stellar wind. Otherwise, you don't generate the Bose shocks. Like if you have, this is what was shown by Hutthof and Kaper, that if you have these stars running through hot bubbles, large scale structures with a very tenuous gas, then you don't develop these structures and you don't see them. So statistically, you expect that these should be detected around, you know, only a fraction of the runaway stars, so 10 to 15% is what people find observationally and also statistically predicted. So many of these now are, these kind of Bose shocks are now detected with all sky surveys, such as WISE, which has a beautiful resolution and a very good sensitivity in the mid-infrared for detecting the dust emission around these stars. So specifically the dust emission we know now a lot about the gas emission we know still very little. I think we need to hurry up also a bit. So, Alexian, you go again to the simulation, yep. But try to hurry up a bit, because
I know. So what actually happened was that Nick had more observations, so immediately he comes knocking on my door, because he has more observations, means he wants more simulations, and the star that he was worried about was BD433654, and that is definitely a very hot star. I mean, this is one monster star. It's an supergiant, nearly a million solar luminosities. And again, it's moving through the interstellar medium. And what we saw in the infrared was that it has this very thick Bose shock layer. I mean, it's almost of the same, the thickness of the shell is almost of the same order of magnitude as the total size of the Bose shock. And that surprised me a bit for reasons which you'll see in a moment. And just based on the analytical approximation, it says that the width of the total interaction region, so the combined shocked ISM and shocked wind region, should scale approximately with, well, the standoff distance R divided by the Mach number of the shock squared. So turning that back, if you actually work it out, it's 0.55 times R over M squared. We fill in the numbers as far as we knew. That meant that we'd have a shock with a Mach number of approximately 1. So it would be moving slowly compared to the sound speed in the ISM. And since we had an estimate of something like 77 kilometers per second for the motion of the star, that would mean the ISM was quite warm, in the order of 10 to the 4 to a few times 10 to the 5 Kelvin. It's not really all that precise. And so we decided to do a few more simulations to see what happened. So again, I plugged in some numbers. 10 to the minus 5 solar mass per year, this is a star that, that loses a huge amount of mass. Fast wind, well, here's the 77 kilometers per second. ISM density, well, always difficult to determine, but if you fill in two particles per centimeter cubed and these numbers, you get the correct standoff distance. So that's where we go. And I said, well, I assume a warm ISM, A, because that makes it easier for me, because that 10,000 minimum makes sure it doesn't get compressed too much. And also because it is reasonable, there is an O star here which dumps enormous numbers of photons in the ISM, so it will photoionize its surroundings. And because ultimately this, what we're observing here is the dust continuum, I added a number of dust species to the simulation, by basically treating them as a pressureless gas and linking them to the actual gas through the drag force. And what I came up with was this. So what we have here is the star. This is the gas density, and this is a combined image of the three dust species. And if we now set the star moving.
So blue are the smallest grains and red are the largest grains.
The smallest ones. We see here is, for the gas, the shocked ISM is a really thin and also highly unstable shell. So this is definitely a case of a radiative shock, whereas the wind shock is adiabatic. And if you were to observe this in the optical, looking at the gas, this thin shell is all you would see, because emission scales with density squared, so this would completely dominate. The shocked wind, which in fact is in the order of a couple of hundred million Kelvin, you'd almost not observe at all. But this is the dust distribution. What you see is that whereas the interstellar medium shell in gas is very thin, the interstellar dust actually makes for a very thick shell. And the reason is that this gas is just not enough to stop the dust grains. The dust, through its own momentum, just plows through and needs a rather long distance to actually come to a stop.
Maybe it's good to remember that in this case, the dust is coming from the ISM, all the dust. So as opposed to the AGB stars, where most of the dust is coming from the star.
There's an O star, so we assume there is no dust in the wind at all. And this actually should serve as something of a warning to observers. If you look in the infrared, be a little bit careful. Always remember, you're looking at the dust, not at the gas in this situation. And you have to be careful about assuming that, oh, I have a dust distribution like this, the gas distribution will automatically be the same. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. So be careful, please. So, Nick?
Yes, so I think we are nearing the end. Conclusions, open questions, 1 minute maybe we can manage. So just to basically I already said all this stuff, so it's okay, but I think Herschel demonstrated that we have quite a ubiquitous occurrence of dusty astrospheres around AGB stars, and we can now really observe all the instabilities and then the microphysics which was predicted by the simulations and the theory. We have independent tools to estimate stellar and interstellar parameters. Also, we now realize that also not only the Bose shock, it's also affected by other factors like the magnetic field, like binarity, which Shashin will undoubtedly highlight, and what Sophia already mentioned, all affect the circumstellar environments within these Bose shock regions. There is some hint of that there is some relation with circumstellar chemistry, and what I said is about the dust mass. Okay, so again, it's primarily detected through the dust so far, so there's very few samples where we have actually the gas emission detector and we can make these kind of comparisons in detail. So weak wind stars is something slightly different, but Bram Oxendorf will talk about this problem where we have decoupling between gas and dust in these dust waves. So combining observations with numerical simulations can help us to understand and the physical processes also. So it's learning something about stellar evolution, something about physics, microphysics, interstellar medium. We learn everything, can do a lot of nice stuff. And for the future?
Yeah, for the future. So what we definitely need is multi-wavelength imaging and spectroscopy. As I already showed, infrared is great, but it has its drawbacks. So ideally, you want to be able to see both the dust and the gas and be able to make a comparison. And it really helps because Bose shocks are fascinating laboratories and they can be used to understand a lot of processes in the interstellar and circumstellar medium. From the numerical point of view, this is very much a work in progress because we're beginning to exhaust the possibilities of pure MHD, so we want to look at new things. For example, introducing actual dust grains. Treating dust as a sort of pseudo-gas works and is relatively easy, but it has its limits. And ideally, we should be able to treat dust grains actually as grains. Another thing that should be added is chemistry. These models never include chemistry, but ideally, you want to have the chemistry as part of a dynamical process in your simulation. Obviously, magnetic fields are very important. And one step we hope will be in the right direction is the Radicals project, which started this year. Lane Dessin, Jeremy Yates from University College, myself, a number of other people. And what we want to do is ultimately build a numerical code which can do all of these things together and is really specialized for circumstellar medium. It's very much a work in progress, and I don't see it yielding results today or tomorrow, but I think it's necessary because we're fiddling around with general purpose codes and we really need a specialized tool. Another point to be considered, and which is usually forgotten, is energy loss through cosmic ray acceleration. For Bose-Shocks, maybe not all that important, but in general for circumstellar bubbles, this is certainly something to keep in mind. And at the moment, it's something everybody just leaves out of the models, and that could be a problem. And yeah, all from the observational point of view, I guess the James Webb is going to be the next magic bullet that will solve all our problems. It's definitely a good tool, because infrared is ideal if you want to separate emission from circumstellar medium from the emission of the star. So I guess we'll just have to wait until it's launched, and then we have no more questions, we only have answers. And with that, we end.
To take your questions.
Thank you very much for this beautiful view. So maybe we have, yes, already one question here, and then one other one here.
Your massive star bubbles, the question is, do you take radiation into the Lyman continuum radiation into account? Because I've not seen an H2 region around this, and we know that Vishniac instability will, for instance, been enhanced by the radiation.
No, what's taken into account in the models right now is radiative energy loss in a simplified form. So we assume LTE, and we just say for a given temperature and chemical composition, you will lose a certain amount of energy scaled to the density squared.
Yeah, but the structure is different if you take also the radiation of the massive star into account.
Yep.
I will talk about this on Friday because I will have I show some models also on a poster.
I don't remember the value of the magnetic field you use for BD plus 43. Can you say it again? Because for this case, it's actually important because this is the only Bose shock that has been detected non-thermal emission. So yep. Actually.
The value for what?
There was no magnetic field.
There's no magnetic field in that model.
No magnetic field?
No.
So, well, it should be interesting to see that because it's the only one who has been estimated from non-thermal radio emission. No.
Hi. As much as I would like to agree with you that Bose shocks are a direct measurement of the wind today with the interstellar medium, I have to disagree with that because you very well know that the mass loss is changing, the velocity is changing in interior, so we cannot really tell what is going on in the Bose shock right now in relation with the wind interaction, at least in AGB stars.
Actually,
early in the beginning, yes, in the beginning of the evolution where you have a constant wind, yes, you can determine a lot of things from the wind, but later on when you enter into the thermal pulses, no way. And the second thing is that, and I really would like it to be the case, you know that I've been working on this a lot, and I would like to be able to tell things from the Bose shock on the wind parameters, but I don't think we can do it. And the second thing is that, have you tried to reduce the density of the ISM before putting magnetic fields to see if you just get rid of instabilities, because the cooling there will allow you to just don't get unstable in this regime. And it's a more easy solution than putting a magnetic field that has to be aligned perfectly with the direction of movement. I mean, just...
Actually, so there's two points here. In terms of variations in mass loss rate and wind, I have experimented with that a lot for Bose shocks. And actually...
Me too.
Bose shocks are like the Muhammad Ali of circumstellar bubbles. You can create enormous variations in your mass loss rate and your wind velocity, and the Bose shock just soaks it up. I think it still gives a decent representation of the average values. It does not respond to the variations at all. In terms of, so for Betelgeuse, the magnetic field, Just reducing the interstellar medium density there is a bit tough, because then you have to justify how you end up still with the right standoff distance. But in general, if you reduce the density but keep a similar magnetic field, the magnetic field will just become more and more important to a point where it actually starts reshaping the entire Bose shock rather than only reducing the instabilities. And then you get a shape which just doesn't fit what Betelgeuse's Bose shock looks like.
You see, if you run simulations, Eva does and Alatjan do, they can get the same different results for the same observations. It's nice.
So very nice talk. I'm still puzzled though. Betelgeuse, I quote Nick, there's also a linear structure here which is not so fascinating.
No, it is also fascinating.
And Allard's told us that there's a discussion going, but you didn't really go into detail. Could you elaborate on it? What do you think it is?
Personally, I think it is interstellar. That, in fact, there is an interstellar cloud and that Betelgeuse is running into it. An alternative which was posed by John Mackey is that what we're actually looking at is an earlier Bose shock created during a blue supergiant phase and which is now collapsing due to lack of wind pressure. That he can create the correct shape in his simulations. The downside to that model is that you have to catch Betelgeuse at exactly the right moment. And I think he had something like a 10,000 year window in which it would look like this. And yeah, I'm a little bit wary of solutions that require an exact point in time for the observation in order to work. But it is a possibility, and I simply don't know. That's why I didn't say anything more about it.
But there are no observations, like large-scale observation, because it's Betelgeuse, like running into the galactic plane, so there could be a lot of stuff.
There are some indications
yes,
that
this stripe is more or less oriented along the galactic plane. Mm-hmm. In hydrogen one, Lane was saying there's some more information, but yeah.
Yeah, very short. So you mentioned Betelgeuse's radial velocity. I mean, that's known. I just looked it up. It's 22 kilometers a second. And that's comparable, I think, to its motion across the sky, certainly within a factor of two. So it's not a mystery how fast it's going away from us.
I have seen other estimates. In fact, I've seen estimates going up to 50 kilometers per second. So I'm not entirely sure about that. But by and large, the between, say, 25 to 30 kilometers per second seems to be correct.
All of this depends on whether you assume the Bose shock is in a steady state or not.
Yeah.
And if it's a young Bose shock, then there's no reason to think that it's in a steady state. Then all of this simple physics goes away, and then we don't know the density of the ISM, and you can assume many different things.
Yeah. What we'd need then is observations. It may be possible to actually detail that whether or not the distance between Betelgeuse and the Bose shock is growing, but I think we'd need something like 10 years or so in order to get that.
And a new infrared space mission.
Can I ask one more question? Sorry. One more. Why is it so hard to observe them in H-alpha Bose shocks?
You observe them everywhere in planetary nebula in H alpha.
No, but the O stars, you see like a very, very small fraction of them show like gas emission line tracers. Why is that?
Do you want to comment on there was more fields like? Well, the emissivity is not high enough. So you're just not sensitive enough